I see a country in quicksand, unable to solve problems and threats from abroad, unable to make life better for people here at home. Nothing gets done. I talk to people who are just like me, who are the first in their family to go to college. They've got a lot of student debt, can't buy a home, can't start a business. I talk to kids who sit in their classroom afraid that they'll be the next victim of gun violence, and they see Washington doing nothing about it after the moments of silence, and they see lawmakers who love their guns more than they love our kids. And none of that is gonna change until we get a leader who is willing to go big on the issues we take on, be bold in the solutions we offer, and do good in the way that we govern. I'm ready to solve these problems. I'm running for president of the United States.
Eric Swalwell on Stephen Colbert last night. You are forgiven if you don't exactly know who Eric Swalwell is. He is a Northern California congressman and now the 18th Democratic candidate running for president. And really, despite Joe Biden's recent bad press for inappropriate behavior, he is still leading, according to several recent polls, followed by Bernie Sanders. Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris are focusing on releasing policies, building their platforms. Beto O'Rourke, Mayor Pete Buttigieg seem to be gaining traction among younger voters. Here to help us sift through all these candidates is Matt Visor, national politics reporter for The Washington Post. Hello.
Hey.
Okay, Eric Swalwell. Not big name recognition, I'm guessing, outside Northern California.
No, although he is sort of a fixture on cable news TV. He is often on, so he may be familiar in that way. He is a four-term congressman from California, trying to make a name for himself. Although he has been on TV quite a bit.
Right. Well, so what is his calling card? What does he say he's going to do the other candidates won't?
So I think he seems to have a more singular focus on gun control issues. It has been a topic for many of the other candidates as well, but I think Congressman Swalwell will put that issue front and center, somewhat similar to Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington State, who's done the same thing with climate change, where it's the topic through which he sees his presidential campaign. I think that's what we'll hear a lot from Swalwell on, and kind of banking on the idea that voters will reward him for that.
Mm-hmm. He's also a lot younger than some of the other candidates. He's 38, so he's in Mayor Pete territory. And is he trumpeting that he is a candidate for the millennials?
Yeah, I mean, we will see, and we're already seeing in this field somewhat of a generational divide. There is, as you mentioned, Mayor Pete Buttigieg is 38. Eric Swalwell in the race. Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman from Hawaii, is also in her late 30s. And Beto O'Rourke in his 40s. So there is a little bit of a generational difference. Them competing, on the other hand, with Bernie Sanders in his 70s, Joe Biden also in his 70s, looking to maybe get in later this month. Elizabeth Warren, also an older candidate.
So what about the age difference? Because you have, you know, I'm looking at early polling, and yes, it is very, very early, but Biden way ahead, Sanders way ahead of all of these other candidates. They are the oldest, whitest men in the race.
And part of that, I think, is a little bit name recognition. Both Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, having been national figures for a long time. At this point in the race, I think that is part of what's guiding their strong polling numbers, that other candidates are trying to test that out and see if they might be able to build a more formidable campaign that will go the long haul. And I think that's a test. And I think that we'll see whether Joe Biden is one of those candidates whose stock goes down the minute he gets in the race. And we'll see a year from now when the nominating contest actually begins.
Hmm. But does it say something also about where the Democratic Party is, like the people who are engaged and would have a choice already and perhaps are more likely to vote are going for the older, more establishment candidates? Like it would be harder for a younger, less established candidate to gain traction with these voters.
I think it will be hard, but a lot of the national polls are frankly measuring not the most engaged people. Most of the polls are maybe likely voters across the country, but people, I think so far, at least talking to people in Iowa and New Hampshire, some of the most engaged voters, they're not making decisions at this point. And I think that's a little bit why we're seeing some of the fluidity where Pete Buttigieg, who most people hadn't heard of a couple weeks ago, is now leaping in the polls and able to raise a healthy $7 million is suddenly in the contest in a way that he wasn't previously. And I think part of that is Democratic voters don't know who they want at this point and are willing to take a risk and sort of shop around still before they make their final decisions.
And what about ideology, hard left versus more mainstream moderate left? Where are the voters on that?
Well, so far, a lot of the energy has been on the more far left. The discussion has been dominated by candidates like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, who've come out with policies that would have been seen on the fringes in past presidential campaigns, but are now becoming a little bit more mainstream. I think that'll change as other candidates get in. Joe Biden, in particular, I think is somebody who more centrist Democrats look toward to sort of rebalance the ideological debate. Beto O'Rourke has also sort of distanced himself and backed away from Medicare for All, which is one of the litmus tests for progressive Democrats. So you're seeing some of the candidates who are getting in the race trying to take things in a little bit more of a moderate direction. But certainly the early part of this contest has been dominated by the progressives in the party.
Mm. No Democrat can win without African Americans going to the polls. Where, I mean, it's again very early, which candidate in general do Black voters prefer?
There are candidates who are putting South Carolina as a particular important piece of their strategy. Kamala Harris has gone several times to South Carolina to the point where there's a little bit of aggravation in some of the Iowa and New Hampshire voters who are used to being lavished with attention. And Cory Booker also has been in South Carolina quite a bit. But it's hard to tell at this point sort of where voters may go. In particular, in the Black community, there's a little bit of a difference between how the older generation looks upon this field versus sort of the Black Lives Matter, a younger generation sort of still trying to figure out where that energy may go.
So this debate on June 26th, how many candidates will be in it so far?
It's unclear. It is dependent on showing at least 1% in three different polls or raising 65 or raising earning contributions from 65,000 unique donors. So most candidates will qualify. They're going to be over two nights. And there won't be the Republicans last time sort of had a kiddie table debate. Mm-hmm. You know, the first debate earlier for candidates who were not seen as formidable. The Democrats are sort of going to mix it up. It'll be random drawings to figure out who will debate on which night. So it'll be over two nights. And it could be quite crowded on that debate stage.
Well, Matt, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Matt Visor, national political reporter for The Washington Post. One issue many of the candidates have discussed is reparations. Most are in favor of some kind of payment to the descendants of slaves, but there have not been a lot of specifics. Well, at Georgetown University, there is a specific plan. Later this week, students will vote on whether to add a tuition fee that would go toward paying reparations to descendants of slaves sold to raise money for the university back in 1838. Joining me now is Jesus Rodriguez. He's a writer for Politico and also a senior at Georgetown. Hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks
Great,
for having
thanks.
Me.
Well, thanks for coming on. So it was just recently discovered that your university sold 272 slaves back in 1838 to pay off some debts. What did the university do when it was faced with that story a few years ago?
So the story has been going on for quite some time, actually. The Jesuits who actually, you know, ran the university for quite some time kept a lot of records about this sale. So this was sort of known, but not just publicly explored. especially in the 90s, sort of some of that groundwork began exploring this sale and this history. But it really came to the forefront, I would say, in 2014, 2015, 2016, when the university began to make some sort of amends for this sale, right? And that includes, you know, an official mass of contrition that was held in 2017 to formally apologize for the sale, giving descendants preference in admissions akin to legacy students. You know, things like renaming halls that were, you know, previously named for the architects of this particular sale in 1838. And, you know, other more minor things such as, you know, encouraging research on this topic, doing events on campus, as well as, you know, audiovisual materials like documentaries and things like that.
Okay. And now this additional idea of assessing students an additional fee to go towards the descendants of these slaves. And so the students would pay for it, not the university?
Right. So there's been a bit of a controversy because it's an entirely student-led initiative. This did not come from the university. In fact, the very reason why students are pushing for this is because they see the university as being too slow in making full amends for this sale in 1838 of 272 slaves that now, you know, has led to over 4,000 living descendants. So in part, this has been an entirely student-led initiative aimed at pressuring the university to, you know, basically sending the message that if we, the students, are, you know, we're willing to do this, why shouldn't the university also be willing to fulfill sort of a commitment that was outlined in a report that came out in August of 2016 that essentially said that, you know, no full restitution could be made without talking about some sort of financial commitment.
So how much financial commitment are they talking about? How much would it cost per student?
So in this case, each student would pay $27.20 per semester. That is a symbolic fee, obviously, you know, meant to represent the 272 slaves who were sold. That fee year on year would raise about $400,000. Those $400,000 would be managed by a fund in a board of reconciliation board that is managed by five descendants and five students, and they would allocate that money to, you know, initiatives such as in healthcare or in education, you know, whatever the descendants decide that is most beneficial to them, because they would at the end be able to apply for these, you know, these grants or these funds.
So they wouldn't necessarily have to be students. They could be any descendant?
Correct. Yeah. Any of the 4,000, you know, living descendants right now who have been identified through the Georgetown Memory Project and others.
And it could come also just as a cash payment?
So they have not actually spoken about cash payments. This has really been targeted at more, you know, public initiatives. So, for example, one of the things that has been talked about is, you know, sending, you know, people have expressed a need for eye exams and things like that down in the places where these, you know, where a lot of the descendants live now, such as, you know, Maringouin and Louisiana outside of Baton Rouge. There are other parishes right around there as well where descendants are concentrated, Maryland as well. Some of these areas where, you know, some of these descendants are really, you know, stricken by poverty and, you know, unable to reach these resources. So that's what they would be targeted to, but not necessarily cash payments.
All right. And so if students agree, will the university abide by that basically in perpetuity?
If students agree, there's still kind of an uphill battle because the referendum which will be voted on Thursday, still has to go through the university board of directors. What students are banking on is that, you know, this referendum, if, you know, students come out overwhelmingly in support of it, would send a very direct message to that board of directors and say, this is what we need to do. This is what the student body is ready to do, and the university should follow through. And that's the message that they're aiming to send on Thursday.
Okay. Jesus Rodriguez writes for Politico. He's a senior at Georgetown University. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
More charges today in the college admissions cheating scandal. Coming up, an inside look at what it's like being a college counselor at an elite LA prep school. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
We're here today to announce charges in the largest college admissions scam ever prosecuted by the Department of Justice. We've charged 50 people nationwide with participating in a conspiracy that involved, first, cheating on college entrance exams, meaning the SAT and the ACT, and second, securing admission to elite colleges by bribing coaches at those schools to accept certain students under false pretenses.
That's U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling announcing charges in the admissions cheating scandal last month. Well, today, federal prosecutors unveiled a superseding indictment. More than a dozen parents, including the actress Lori Loughlin and her husband Massimo Giannulli, now face additional charges of money laundering. 13 parents pled guilty yesterday to the original fraud and conspiracy charges, so they were not charged with that additional money laundering count. And of those 13 parents, that included actress Felicity Huffman. In a written statement, she says she's, quote, ashamed and wants to apologize to the students who work hard every day to get into college and to their parents who make tremendous sacrifices to support their children and do so honestly. Well, the scandal came as a surprise to some people, but to others, not really. Caitlin Flanagan is a contributing editor at The Atlantic. She also worked as a college counselor at the elite prep school Harvard Westlake for 3 years back in the 90s. Her most recent article for The Atlantic is called They Had It Coming. Hi. So they had it coming, huh?
I think so, probably. Yeah. Finally, justice has been served.
Right. Okay, so before I get to your experience, I want just to get your reaction to Felicity Huffman. I mean, it seems like a pretty heartfelt statement of remorse, and you're kind of rolling your eyes.
I hate to be cynical, but, you know, there are a lot of white-collar criminal advisors out there. And the first thing they will recommend in a big federal case like this with multi-defendants is that you want to come out right away with a guilty plea, because the way these things are sentenced is the first people, the earlier you come in with a guilty plea, the earlier you're a cooperating witness, the sooner, the more benefits you're going to get in your own sentencing. And sometimes people who were less involved get longer sentences than people who were more involved simply because they pled sooner. Mm. And the first thing those guys will say, I mean, I have to say her letter is a textbook from the templates you see online of, I feel guilty, I feel remorseful, I want to repair.
Yeah.
And typically with white-collar criminals, defendants, typically it takes them a long time to really have that feeling of remorse and guilt and to really feel that they are guilty of something. So I don't cast any aspersions per se on her letter, but I have to say it almost fills in the template of what those advisors will tell you to write.
Interesting. Well, in fact, you touch on that feeling of entitlement when it comes to this whole process in your article. And you really look at the other big name in this scandal, Lori Loughlin and her husband, the fashion entrepreneur,
and Massimo.
And you say that they are really the, as you say in the article, uncontested winners of worst people so far to be indicted. Why are they the worst people?
Well, you know, there are all these people in these various stories who are on the take. You know, there's the guy, Rick Singer, who set the system up. There are the coaches who are on the take. There are the parents who, in a sense, are on the take in that they're funding it. But at the very, very bottom of their pyramid, their inverted pyramid, is the college counselor, the guidance counselor at the high school, which is the job. I was a teacher before that, and then I was a college counselor. And they are just people honestly and earnestly doing their best and working and not getting any, no aspersion has, and I don't think ever will be cast on college counselors. And when this college counselor of their child, of Lori Loughlin's child, realized, wait a minute, this girl doesn't row crew, and she's being admitted to USC as a member of the crew team, and she asked the girl about it, and the father roared onto campus and just yelled at her. It's all in the affidavit. He yelled at her, and she just completely demoralized her, and she had to write this horrible letter back to him saying, I am so sorry, and I understand your daughter, Rose Crewe, when she clearly didn't. And so when these people abuse teachers and guidance counselors, I just think that is just beneath contempt.
Well, and so they see the guidance counselor as what exactly? As the person who's going to get their kid who may not have the best scores or grades into these elite schools?
When we're talking about these private schools, the very expensive private schools that can cost $36,000, $40,000 here in Los Angeles, the college counselor is sort of seen as well, they're more of a conduit between the kid and the school than many parents realize. I think that's part of why things were starting to bubble up even before the indictment of guidance counselors. I've talked to many around town who said, you know, there was a thing a couple of years ago where a kid was, you know, a college person said, oh yeah, he's on the such and such team. And I started to question it. That's been kind of bubbling up, because what I think people in the scam didn't realize is that at a private school, you're on the phone extensively with the elite colleges, and you're talking over the kids one by one. So they tried to cut that person out of the chain of information, but I think this would have come to light eventually in a year or so, because all these college counselors were getting these weird reports from college admissions people.
So in the case of Lori Loughlin's daughter saying, wait a minute, she doesn't recruit. Like, what's happening? How did that happen?
There were three parents that this happened to. One of them was named Sloan, and he was outraged that the college counselor would get involved at all, and said, you know, my child has privacy rights. And, you know, this is just ridiculous. The role of the college counselor is to help the child, and has full, you know, they're a school official. They have full access to all of the child's records to help them to get into these various colleges. So to come down hard on people, I guarantee you that the college counselor at Marymount High School that he came in and yelled at, she doesn't make more in a year than the car that he drove over there cost. Mm. So for them to be squashing educators is just, to me, that's just really foul.
So the title of your piece is They Had It Coming, but you make it clear that when you were working as a college counselor, you didn't see any illegal activity.
I didn't see anything like what's going on now, the explicit bribing of coaches, but I certainly saw that coaches were strangely empowered. You know, I certainly knew about the big ticket sports, basketball and football, which we didn't really tend to have those sorts of students anyway, rarely. That was kind of a big business. But I didn't realize until I got there that every kind of effete private school sport, from all the expensive water polo and swimming and, you know, volleyball, all these things, the coaches are all given sort of 8 or 9 or 10 spots. They don't always need that many spots to fill their roster. And
the coaches
rest,
at the colleges.
The coaches at the colleges, yeah. And so the college admissions people say, so long as, you know, just tell us who you want and we will admit them. And so there was a lot of leeway for the coaches to monetize these spots. And I'm very pro coach. You know, I think coaches are like nurses. They're, you know, the good ones are fantastic, and I think most of them probably are good. But I think we've seen the tip of the iceberg as far as how many of these coaches have been monetizing the available spots they have to get into these elite colleges.
And by monetizing, you mean actually
selling them,
taking money,
taking money. Yes.
What about the idea of these kids taking spots from other more deserving kids, kids who actually played by the rules?
That is, well, the colleges have a really close eye on enrollment management. So the one thing we can feel comfortable about is these kids who bought their way in, they didn't steal a space from an underprivileged kid or a kid who needed financial aid. That's a whole separate admissions category. Mm. So they probably stole a spot from another private school kid, you know, which isn't right at all. That is also terrible. But at least we can be assured that the other private school kid landed somewhere that he or she had earned his or her way into. But this is just the very elite families kind of chewing each other's tails off in the rat cage.
Well, I guess, you know, we're all scratching our heads and wondering, well, why did they bother doing this? They have everything. They've got the money. They're already in these elite prep schools. Of course, they would go to some good school, or well, they would succeed in life anyway because they have so much money.
Well, in this case of these very wealthy, mostly white families, what we're seeing is America has changed. It's not just changing, it has changed. The demographics of these very elite colleges do reflect America's demographics far more than they did 30 years ago. And so the number of spots just for white students, let alone white wealthy students, you know, the 1927 handbook of Milton School, a very elite boarding school back east, says each boy will go to Harvard upon graduation, comma, or the college of his parents' choice. That was how the system worked. You chose it. Even the field I worked in, college counseling, until a few years before I got there, it was always called college placement. The prep schools placed their kids where they wanted to go.
And it's called college preparatory.
Exactly. So. And to them, that doesn't mean any college. That doesn't mean a state university. That means the kind of elite schools that we read about in F. Scott Fitzgerald and the boys would go from Exeter to Princeton. That America's gone. And so I saw it as kind of an issue of the same kind of white displacement that brought Trump voters, you know, to vote for Trump, this idea that for poor whites, the loss of manufacturing jobs is a little bit like for wealthy whites, the loss of the almost automatic entree to certain colleges. And the level of rage that I saw even 25 years ago that's only gotten worse and led to this criminal scheme, the idea that something's been taken away from us, then we didn't even notice it was happening, and we have to get it back. It belongs to us. I really vividly remember one time in the office at Harvard Westlake, and it was in the office next door to me, but we could all hear it. This father, he had gone to Yale, his older son had gone to Yale, and the younger son had not gotten in. And the father was so unraveled, and he yelled to the college counselor, "I went to Yale. My older son went to Yale. It's Nick's turn." And we were all like, there's no turn. You don't get a turn. Although the colleges, in their very corrupt way, kind of say you do because they give extra points for and the fact
for
that,
the legacies,
which
right?
is that's an aristocracy right there, yeah. that you can inherit a place in society. That's not an American idea.
OK, so you have Felicity Huffman saying her daughter knew nothing about this and she feels terrible. She'll have to deal with that for the rest of her life. A lot of these kids didn't know what was happening.
Correct.
So what does it do to them when they find out?
Or even beyond those, just let's just even take a step back to just the kind of kid whose parents, you know, maybe upper middle class parents who are so focused not just on getting a child to college, but getting a certain kind of college. They're telling their kid quite explicitly, who you are isn't enough for me. That everything you achieved and everything you are in this whole portfolio of work and all the times you failed and scrambled back on your feet, you know, and managed to get through things, that's not enough for me. I don't want to have a child who goes to Ohio State. I want to have a child who goes to Williams College. And no matter what happens to the kid, if they don't get into Williams College or whatever highly selective school, they know that they failed their parents. And if they do go there, they obviously have imposter syndrome, and quite deservedly so, because they didn't get there on their own credentials and abilities. They went there because their parents went nuts and bought or bribed or cajoled or pulled every favor. And there's a lot of favors that they can pull. And now they have this spot. So it's incredibly hurtful to these developing young people.
So what about prison time? They're saying they're all going to face prison time. I mean, prison? That sounds like a pretty serious thing for them to experience.
Well, the first thing is I'd really like to change the conversation. They may serve time, but it won't be in anything like a prison that a young black male who was caught selling a very small amount of serious drugs would go to. This is when they say camp fed, it is camp fed. There are wonderful exercise facilities. The food's not terrible. Some of them have private bathroom facilities. All the terror that people have, and rightly so, about prison and prison rape and all these issues we care so much about, that almost never occurs at a camp-fed environment. So, you know, I don't know if they will or won't go, but I don't think we should even say prison. We need to say it's a very comfortable, exceedingly comfortable camp. And men who have been there have openly called it like their own summer camps that they went to.
Nice. So maybe it's like a little bit of a break.
It's a little break.
It's a retreat.
It's work on their own volleyball skills and they can get into USC.
Caitlin Flanagan, contributing editor at The Atlantic, where you can read her latest article. It's called They Had It Coming. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Friday is the deadline for Hollywood writers and agents to come to an agreement.
There is a very good chance, you know, that there won't be a deal and that this will turn into a chaotic situation, there is also the possibility that someone, in part the Writers Guild, will blink.
That story next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so that means it's time for our regular TV segment we call TV on the Radio. Today, we want to talk about TV writers. And even though it is the golden age of television, those people who write television shows say their work conditions in many ways are really not golden. That's because they say they are making less money because their agents now have a conflict of interest. They're acting more like producers. And the writers have given their agents a Friday deadline to agree to a new contract that would be a quote-unquote code of conduct for their agents. Jonathan Handel is an entertainment attorney and contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter. He's here now to break down this pretty complicated issue. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, Madeline.
All right, so first, big picture. How did the role of the agent change, and when did it do so?
Well, and it actually turns out that it hasn't changed. This has been a conflict between the guilds and agents since the earliest days of agenting in Hollywood, going back to the 1930s. I think the trigger was the formation of a company called Endeavor Content, which is an affiliate of big talent agency WME, William Morris Endeavor, WME. And that happened about a year and a half ago. And in turn, really as a result of big infusions of private equity money starting in 2010 into the top three talent agencies. That private equity was premised on the idea that the agencies could leverage their relationships with writers and other talent and become content owners themselves. But when Endeavor Content got formed in fall of 2017, that seems to have really been a straw that broke the camel's back, even though the camel had its nose under the tent for the past 80 years. The Writers Guild held meetings, and then in April of 2018, last year, they issued a one-year notice of termination, terminating the agreement between the Writers Guild and the talent agencies, but on a one-year look-ahead basis, because that's the way the agreement is written. We've now come to April of 2019, and that's how we are where we're at today.
So, Jonathan, we're hearing a lot of these terms being thrown around in this dispute, this agreement. We're hearing the term packaging fees and affiliate production. Can you explain what those mean?
Yes, two separate concepts, although both relate to agents acting in one shape or another as producers. With packaging fees, and let's focus particularly on television, television packaging fees are a system where the studio pays the talent agency rather than the talent agency receiving commissions from its own clients. The agency goes to the studio with a package, in other words, a writer, a pilot script, and a lead actor for the series. And if the studio likes the package, they'll agree to pay fees directly to the agency, and the agency in turn will forego commissioning the writer and actor and other elements on the series.
And that means less money for the writer? Seems like it would be more money because the writer doesn't have to pay the agent.
It directly means more money for the writer because the writer doesn't have to pay the agent. But the Writers Guild says that by not being a percentary, that the agency is not incentivized to maximize income for the writer. That instead they're busy negotiating their fee with the studio and are less aggressive in negotiating writers' fees. It's a heavily disputed issue, and at the end of the day, it's very hard to know, you know, what the evidence is or where it shakes out. Now, affiliate production. The talent agencies are setting up affiliated companies, sister entities, that themselves are production companies or mini studios. So the agencies become potential buyers for their own clients' projects and produce the projects and co-own them with the creators. The agencies say this is bringing new buyers into the market. The guild says this is an untenable conflict of interest.
So, for example, with WME, you have Endeavor Content.
That's correct.
Well, I guess the proof is in the pudding, if you will. Are writers making less money now than they would have or they were a few years ago, relatively speaking?
Well, yes and no. It's a tale of two cities, as it often is. The very top writers, the mega showrunners like Shonda Rhimes, J.J. Abrams, and so forth are more in demand than ever and are making eye-popping sums of money and doing enormous deals. But the Writers Guild says that the sort of more rank-and-file television writers, that their median income has stagnated. Now, they haven't released detailed figures beyond, you know, sort of half a dozen numbers, so it's hard to evaluate. But what's also hard to evaluate is the Writers Guild says, look, this is the fault of the agencies. The agencies say, no, this is because the studios have gained leverage and also because of shorter seasons. Writer used to be hired on a 22-episode network series. They'd be guaranteed a certain number of episodes, script writing within that 22, and you know, you had basically a year-round job. Now, with many series being, you know, 8 or 10 or 12 episodes, the amount of work for writers and the amount of work that they get guaranteed is less. And so the agencies say, look, this is a product of changing viewership patterns and changing production patterns. It's not the fault of the agencies.
So what will happen, do you think? What if they do fire their agents? That's 13,000 writers, right?
What if 15,000. Yeah, 15,000 members. 15,000 members between East and West, although some of them, you know, are writers in news shows and things that this doesn't apply to. So yeah, 12, 13,000 writers are probably, you're right, is probably what's at issue. And this code of conduct would prohibit packaging fees and affiliate production. None of the major agencies and none or almost none of the medium-sized agencies are expected to sign, which would make those agencies off limits to writers under Writers Guild rules, which then leads to the likelihood that if there is no deal by Friday night, that the Writers Guild will order those writers to fire their agents, as you allude to. What happens then? The Writers Guild says that a patchwork of networking and managers and an online submission system for work will fill the gaps. But there's really essentially no one outside of the Writers Guild, or few people, I would say, outside of the Writers Guild who believe that that's going to be an adequate substitute for what agents do. Because, you know, love them or not, what the knowledge that agents have is they know what the buyers want and they know who their clients are. So the possibility of chaos during staffing season, which begins, this is staffing for the broadcast television shows, which begins, you know, essentially now, is really quite great.
Do you think the writers will back down?
I think it's very, very hard to know. There, you know, I know that's an unsatisfying answer, but this is, the Writers Guild has been very firm, very adamant. The agencies have been equally firm and adamant. I think that there is a very good chance that they, you know, that there won't be a deal and that this will turn into a chaotic situation. There is also the possibility that someone, in part the Writers Guild, will blink. But the Guild has been very assertive in its rhetoric that packaging fees are illegal kickbacks and that there's no compromise on conflicts of interest. These are matters of principle. And, you know, that creates a situation where it really is not easy to pivot. And, you know, membership organizations, unions like the Guild, are in a tough situation because to gain maximum leverage, they have to rile up their members. But in doing that, there's a tendency, or can be, and certainly is with the Writers Guild, to paint things at the most extreme and to say, you know, we absolutely will not compromise on X, Y, and Z. And that then makes it hard to make harder to make a deal when inevitably, you know, you do have to compromise. I mean, a negotiated agreement is not a shopping spree. Neither side gets everything they want.
And the deadline is Friday midnight?
Yeah, Friday midnight, you know, Friday night slash Saturday at 12:01 a.m. That's an extension from a 6-day extension from the previous deadline.
All right. Well, I guess we'll see if it'll be chaos or not at 12:02.
It remains to be seen. This is a 43-year-old agreement between the two sides that is now in one shape or another terminating.
Jonathan Handel, entertainment attorney and contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Thank you.
Thanks very much, madam.
Coming up, chasing Bigfoot. Why one scientist, and maybe it is just one, believes he's real. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. One of the most enduring American legends is Bigfoot, also known as Sasquatch or Wild Man. Basically, a big hairy man beast roaming the woods somewhere out there. The Bigfoot legend has been around since, about the 19th century. Why it hasn't died? Well, that's a mystery, too. A mystery journalist Laura Krantz set out to solve, or at least understand. And because we live in the modern age, not the 19th century, she made a podcast about it called Wild Thing. Laura's here now. Hi.
Hi.
Well, most scientists scoff, right?
Yes.
I mean, they say this is crazy. This does not exist. But you have a relative
who
is an anthropologist, a well-respected anthropologist who's a believer. How come?
Well, let's see. He got his career going probably in the 70s and was a tenured professor of anthropology at Washington State. And I think he saw some evidence, probably must have been in the early 70s, where he saw a footprint that was supposedly a Bigfoot footprint. And when he saw the cast of it, he said, there's no way that anybody faked this. The anatomical detail is too good, and they would have to be an expert in anthropology and anatomy. And he felt that it really was a legitimate piece of evidence of Bigfoot's existence. And after that, he was kind of sold.
Yeah, literal Bigfoot.
Yes.
Bigfoot. How big was that foot?
I think that one was roughly 18 inches.
Okay. So, a credible source when it comes to believing in Bigfoot?
More so than I think a lot of other people who had come forth at that time period and said Bigfoot is real. He had done a lot of work in anthropology, in physical anthropology, and that it's a very scientific field from the standpoint of understanding evolution and biology and anatomy. What got me is because this is a guy who'd done like serious work on evolutionary topics and had like weighed in on some of the big debates of the time. Like, and how's this guy who is a total scientist then turn around and say, yeah, I'm looking for Bigfoot. Like those two things didn't mesh in my mind. And that's what got me like interested.
That's what got you hooked. So you're like, well, there's got to be something here to examine.
Yeah. If this guy's willing to like put his career on the line and like, cause he knew he was the laughingstock and it totally like screwed up his, you know, it slowed down his promotion to tenure and getting a full professor position at Washington State. So it messed with his career and he knew it was going to do that and he did it anyway. So I just wondered, like, if you're going to risk it, why risk it for Bigfoot?
Right. Because he was a believer. It's almost like a religion, it seems like.
Right. He wouldn't say believer. He would say, I know Bigfoot is real. And his exact point is that belief is faith and he knew Bigfoot was real.
And it all came from the footprint. But was there more evidence?
There was the footprint. There were some other footprints. There was a film that was shot in 1967. It was a film called the Patterson-Gimlin film. And probably everybody has seen this film. It's a 1-minute clip of like really shaky footage of a Bigfoot striding away through the clearing in a California forest and then looking back over its shoulder. It's been analyzed to death. And nobody has ever been able to really prove that it is fake. So that is also still held up as a compelling piece of evidence. And that was one of the things that this relative of mine, Grover, was certain was real. And he spent so much time analyzing it. He did frame by frame breakdowns of like the stride length and the height. I mean, he must have just like been sitting there with his finger on the pause button over and over and over again, like trying to take all the information he could get out of it.
So there's no plausible explanation, like some guy in a suit, like a...
Well, there have been three different people to claim that they were the guy in the suit. And there's been other people who have claimed that they know the guy who made the suit. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff about that people have said that they are part of this great hoax. But when you have three people come forward and say they're the guy in the suit, then it starts to make you wonder, well, why would there be three of you? So then it sounds like people are trying to make a name for themselves and maybe the thing is legitimate. There's questions all over the place.
But other cultures have similar man-beast creatures, right? Like the Yeti mm-hmm. in the Himalayas.
Yep.
Or there's like a That's Yowie a big one. In Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So why is this not just something that can be explained as a common cultural trope or a common creature, a mythological creature that humans want to believe in?
You know, the thing with Bigfoot is there are a lot of people who think Bigfoot is real, but there are an equal number of people, probably more people, who don't think Bigfoot is necessarily real, but they like the idea of it. And that trope that you're talking about, that sort of theme that resonates throughout different different societies across the world, I think gets at that. Like this idea of a big, wild, untamed creature living on the peripheral edge of society, you know, doing all the things that humans would have done if we hadn't started putting on pants and paying taxes and working for the man.
Do you believe, after having done all this research, are you with Grover?
No.
Are you Team Grover or not Team Grover?
Well, I'm always Team Grover. my feeling is, unless there is the kind of evidence like substantial, a piece of a body or DNA evidence that really stacks up, like the kinds of things that would allow a creature like this to be classified by science, that's the piece that's missing. And that's the piece that's been missing from this from the beginning, basically. So unless somebody comes forward with that, it's really hard for me to say that Bigfoot is real in the present day and existing. But I would say my stance is I really want to believe. I really like the idea that the world is wild enough that something like this could live out there.
So you want to believe that this thing could exist. Why?
Mm-hmm. It kind of gets to the idea that I like that we haven't explored everything, that we haven't completely been everywhere and already mapped everything. If that is the case, if we've already sort of found everything there is to be found on this planet, it kind of makes things a little less exciting.
Yeah, it's kind of boring. All right. Well, good luck.
Yeah. Well, hopefully people will go out and go looking. Oh, yeah. I mean, my feeling on this is like, you know, if it gets people out into the woods and enjoying nature, who cares if they're looking for something that's not real?
Exactly. Because they'll get something that's better.
And and maybe they'll be keen on preserving wilderness and environment, and this is what'll get them excited about those ideas.
Yeah, that's great. Okay. All right, I'm down with Bigfoot now. I'm Team Grover.
Okay. Team Grover, all the way.
Laura Krantz, host and creator of Wild Thing. Get it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can read her essay on Bigfoot in High Country News. Laura, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Michelle Aloy is here with some listener feedback.
Hey, Madeline.
Some Bigfoot feedback.
We asked our listeners what they thought. Do they think Bigfoot is real? Have they seen it? Him? Her? 51% said definitely a myth. 33% are like Laura Krantz, who we just interviewed. They say they want to believe. Another 8% say they are on the hunt. And this was the most shocking. 8% said Bigfoot lives and they've seen it. And I don't
what?
Know. If, yeah. I don't know if they differentiate between ironic votes or not. But like, if you're that person, you know, tell us your story. We want to hear what you have to say.
We want to see
that.
The video.
Yeah.
Evidence.
Yeah.
That
casual
video,
stroll.
That 1967 film, yeah. The Zapruder of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
That's a really casual Bigfoot.
A stretch.
Yeah.
The Bigfoot looks, you know, like he's got a purpose. He's striding purposefully.
He looks like a businessman in a gorilla suit.
I would say that is true. He does look like that.
Oh, man. I mean, yeah. I mean, I don't think like wild creatures just kind of like casually stroll through the woods like that. I mean, I don't even look that relaxed when I'm hiking, so.
Michelle Aloy, thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.